Welcome to today's Corporate Venturing Insider series. Today is going to be so special. We have Ilya Strebulov, who was my professor at Stanford and gave me all the important tips on how to design TDK ventures. Ilya, welcome.
Thank you for having me here, Nicola. Well, I gave you some of the tips, not all the tips, okay?
And since you teach me about corporate venturing, you even wrote a book. But before we get to that book, which is truly amazing, and I thought it was for venture capitals, but actually it's for big corporations to think like venture capitalists. Let's start with, why did you get interested by corporate venturing in the first place?
First of all, I came to Stanford 20 years ago, and I came as a professor of finance. Now, what do professors of finance teach? They teach finance. Like all young assistant professor of finance, at Stanford, I would teach basic finance, okay? And then I had students who would take my corporate finance class. And then they would go out and become investment bankers, then become chief finance officers, that became managers at large companies. And they would follow finance principles that I imbued in them. And then I noticed that there are some students who would become founders or would become venture capitalists, like institutional venture capitalists. And they would violate every single principle I gave them. And of course, I thought that they all must be absolutely wrong. So let me find out why they're wrong and how can I right them. And so that's why I became interested in venture capital. And I quickly realized that venture capitalists make decisions differently. But I was not really either intrigued or in fact knew much about corporate venture. And again, that was about 15 years ago, okay? But, you know, being a researcher, I was interested in the gamut of experiences. And so I spent already at the time a couple of years learning about institutional venture capital. And of course, institutional venture capitalists all say they're very different from each other. And there are many differences. But then when you talk to two corporate venture people from two different VC funds, they're so different that in comparison, all those institutional VCs are very, very alike. And that piqued my curiosity for the first time. And then something else happened, which is really interesting, which is my colleagues and I did, at the time, the largest ever survey of venture capitalists. So we did the survey of institutional and corporate venture capitalists. But what transpired is that while our survey was amazingly successful in studying how institutional venture capitalists make decisions, how they're structured, how they're compensated, and so on and so forth, our survey on CVCs, frankly, was a failure. Why? Because two different CVCs, they even don't use the same terminology, and they understood questions that were asked differently. Okay? And that really increased my appetite for learning more about CVCs. And then what we did with my team at Stanford is we decided, you know what, we need to go and talk to corporate VCs. And so my real investigation of corporate VCs started when we identified every single corporate VC fund of S&P 500. And I believe every single one of them but two agreed to talk to us. And so we conducted in-depth, lengthy interviews. But as a result of that, I think, came that first insight paper, which is organizational structure and design of corporate VCs. And so what surprised me is that I realized that the way corporate VCs were designed likely would not position most of them for success. And while I expected this to be 20-30%, that was way more than 50%. In fact, the majority of corporate VC units, in my opinion, should not be successful, based on what I've seen, okay? Independent of what they were telling me. And in fact, even though, of course, you know, 3 years later, 32% of them no longer with us. It's 3 years later, okay? And 5 years later, way more. And I think even some of those who are still with us are kind of zombies. So that is, I think, was a big surprise. One of the big surprises.
So when we met in 2018, I remember you started, so the week before we had Jesper Sorensen talking about CVCs, why we should do it. And I remember you asking the class, do you know about CVCs? And we were all proud, we just learned about it. So you say, yes. And then you say, it nearly always never work, which was basically the summary of that survey.
Yes. So, you know, the CVC almost never works. But what is really amazing, and that was the second surprise, okay, so the other side of the coin, is that, in fact, that survey and subsequent research showcased quite clearly that if you design the CVC correctly, not only it should work, but it would. And I think that is a very important statement, is that there are so many different ways to design this CVC unit incorrectly that, unfortunately, it doesn't work very often. By the way, you know, you don't need to be a rocket scientist to understand how to design corporate venture unit appropriately. Sometimes, maybe, as a senior executive in a company, you should be brave, because some of the decisions you'll make in designing the CVC unit might be unpopular with the rest of the organization, with the rest of the management. And by the way, there is no one single way to design CVC unit correctly. There's one thing about what you should do which is critical, independent of what you do. You have to be consistent. Because it's not that there are check marks. It's not that you have to do this and that. All these decisions that you have to make, they are, in fact, related to each other. So consistency is key. So avoid certain things. There's a check mark of what to avoid, or ideally avoid, and then there's consistency.
And I think part of the key element of your course was about start with a strategy and then make your decision, and your design choices come from that. But let's talk about the hygiene part, which is what not to do. What would be the thing that was true when you started the survey and today? What are the things that have not changed you should not do, because that would not lead to a successful CVC?
What you definitely should not do. First is that, and this is maybe more not for CVC leaders, this is more for their parents. First is that you need to know that venture requires patience. And it takes typically a longer time than your traditional standard corporate projects in whatever industry you are. So that it requires patience. By the way, from the strategic point of view, it does not mean that you need to wait for 20 years or for 10 years. Tangible, strategic stuff, KPIs can come before. But don't expect, as a rule, if a corporation expects a return, either strategic or financial, within 3 years, I would not start a CVC. So this would be my number one check. And again, this is my experience that I think corporate leaders just don't really understand. So they don't really have the venture mindset. In fact, this was one of the results of that survey that we later confirmed when we expanded the survey, is that I believe something like 65 to 75% of corporate parents do not really have the venture mindset. They just do not understand, okay? Second is that, look, the venture business is quite competitive. It's particularly competitive in good times, but it's really competitive always. As a result of this, there is an adverse selection, which means that if you offer bad terms, you likely will get bad companies. Now, and for this, you need to offer standard terms, and you need to offer what kind of my value proposition to those companies. Because very often the value proposition is outside the terms, it's outside the valuation. And by the way, again, if you design CVC correctly, I think every single company, whether in the US, whether outside the US, if it's a large company, it can offer, in fact, a lot of value proposition. And just very often, leaders of those companies don't ask themselves this question: what can we offer small startups? And very often when they go through this exercise, oh wow, we actually have a lot to offer. Number three, I would say the reporting structure, which is, and that depends on the specific company, specific structure, specific organizational design of the parent company. But typically, if the CVC is reported to the people who at the end of the day are not interested in strategic mandate or have different incentives, for whatever reason, the CVC is just less likely to be successful. For example, so let's say the CVC is reporting to a chief finance officer. Chief finance officer of any large company at the end of the day is in charge of making sure that the company is not losing money, especially if it's a public company on a quarterly basis. And so reporting to the CFO is not the best decision. Now, what could be good ideas? And again, there's no one perfect solution. I guess the CEO or the chairman or the board of directors would be best. The chief strategy officer, I think, is also a good idea. Okay, maybe chief innovation officer that some companies have. But this is, again, you have to think through how you position CVC within your larger organization. And at the end of the day, for the CEO specifically, for the board, it all starts, why do we need CVC at all? What do you think is the strategic mandate of that corporate venture unit? But you have a lot of work to do, first on exploring what actually you need from a CVC, and then reconcile the differences.
Yeah. I think one of the golden nuggets is consensus makes sense when you have a high level of certainty or skills versus a lack of consensus needed, or even the anti-veto concept, where you have a very high level of uncertainty.
Yes. So I think that is critical. I think uncertainty is important. I think it also depends on the type of uncertainty. When you buy a lottery ticket, you can think it's very uncertain. Now, but I don't think you don't need consensus here.
Yeah.
I think you can think of kind of linear and nonlinear uncertainty.
Okay.
And when there is a lot of nonlinearities present, so that we just cannot, it's just very difficult to predict what's going to happen. So everybody talks now about generative AI. Okay. But if you go back 10 years down the road, but even 5 years down the road, smart people did not realize that it was coming. In research, we often talk about S curves, and by the way, so why S? It's the adoption of new something. People think about new technology, but actually it's new processes, new stuff.
Yep.
So effectively, if you think about this, it's initially nobody cares about it, okay? And of course, many new technologies, new ideas die off anyway. But then there's a point where it reaches critical mass, and then suddenly it becomes interesting. Suddenly it becomes widespread.
Yep.
And it's very difficult to predict when this moment happens and if this moment is going to happen, okay? So as a result of this, corporate leaders should realize is that they cannot predict the future, but in fact, they don't need to predict the future. They need to design for the future, or they need to design to be able to catch the future. And building that decision-making process is one very clear-cut way.
That's a golden nugget. And actually, if you think about the mission of a CEO and their board, is to plan for the future, to make sure the company will continue to grow, do well, scale, and not be disrupted. How would you help them think about whether to have a CVC or a different type of corporate innovation or corporate venturing?
Yeah. It's a great question. There are many companies like that. So first of all, in whatever industry you are, if your business has been stable or traditionally unstable, like the recessions, etc., the next 10 years is going to be different. I can guarantee you. I'm teaching at Stanford venture capital. It's a very popular class. I have hundreds and hundreds of students who became founders of venture-backed companies. I've never seen such a variation in industries that my students start their companies in, okay? Like, I cannot name an industry where they don't start a company, and that's so different from what was 10, 15, 20 years ago. Now, as a result of this, the first premise that you have to start with is whatever your industry is, whatever your geography is, the next 10 years will be much less stable. Second is how to prepare for it. And I do believe that's this question, which, by the way, does not need to be just about CVC, but should be more broadly about how we survive in the next 10 years, how we can implement corporate innovation in this disruptive world. Now, CVC is only one answer. There are many other answers, but I think the CVC is a very powerful answer.
If anything, you talked about maybe below 1 billion, you can't afford the CVC, but it feels like once you get to 2, maybe $3 billion, you can't afford not to have a CVC. Now, I want to move to your book, because your book really surprised me. I thought it was meant for VCs, but actually it's meant for corporations to start having the same mindset, the venture mindset, as venture capitalists.
Yeah. VC is not the target audience. But the book is about how VCs, how smart VCs make decisions. And the book is really for a modern decision maker who lives in a new disruptive environment. By definition, every single corporate executive lives these days in this environment. Now, the whole premise of the book is that, first, VCs make decisions differently, at least from most corporations.
Mm-hmm.
Second, is that in the past, it was a niche industry of no interest. And that is because VCs historically invested in disruptive industries, And the world is full of disruption. Disruption typically happens in a specific industry or a specific period of time. It took longer. And nowadays, it's happening everywhere, in every single industry, in every single space, geographic space, industry space, etc. And so VCs have been facing this for 50 years. As a result of this, not just because they are smart, but because in order to survive and succeed in this hostile environment, they had to come up as a body with new ways of making decisions. And I believe that it's really not just possible or important, but it behooves modern decision maker today to use that knowledge. So this is why we called it the venture mindset, not the venture capital mindset, the venture mindset. Mm-hmm.
That one doesn't surprise me at all. You have 9 principles. We won't have time to go through the 9, but which one do you think it would be the most contrarian to what a CEO of a big company would think in terms of decision making?
I would go to principle number 1, which is what we say, using baseball analogy, home runs matter, strikeouts don't. Now, corporate leaders and corporations as bureaucratic structures are typically risk averse. Mm. Okay? Now, senior executives, not the CEO, but senior executives are risk averse because they know that failure can lead to punishment. Now, however, the CEOs should think about their corporations, especially those 2 billion plus corporations, as portfolio of bets. And here I would like to tell a story. It might be apocryphal, by the way, because there are so many, you know, stories, you never know, they're fictitious or non-fictitious, about Tom Watson, the IBM legendary CEO. Mm-hmm. When the same happened in IBM many years ago, and a senior executive lost a lot of money on a project, he was called to the CEO office. And he came with a letter of resignation because he was absolutely certain that he would be fired, okay? And Watson said, no, I've just spent $25 million on your education. I mean, $25 million was a lot of money, by the way. I'm not really sure whether that actually happened, okay? But I think that is an amazing idea. Now, it doesn't mean, by the way, that any single failure is good. So VCs would invest in founders that failed and failed, but they would explore why those founders failed. Mm. Okay? So it's exactly the same here. It's not about failure. It's about whether the failure was constructive.
Did you learn from it? One of our investment director, one of our portfolio companies ceased operation. We had invested $1 million. I asked him, what did he learn and what would he do differently? And there was a lot he learned, a lot he would do differently. I say, good, that was a $1 million education.
Exactly, yeah. Okay, exactly. Stanford is expensive, but I think it's still less than $1 million, I think. Maybe Stanford should increase to $1 million, okay?
Let's not give bad ideas to the dean. So what would be another principle in the book which the CEO of a big corporations could use to change a mindset inside the team? So here I'm really thinking about mindset change. Because it's not sufficient just to have the CEO having venture mindset. You need this to percolate.
I agree. Let me talk about another principle that I really like, and that I think one principle that VCs don't need a reminder about, but large corporations do. The principle which we call in the book, get outside of four walls.
Yeah.
Now, so if you're a corporate employee, so just close your eyes, okay, and ask yourself a question. How much time you spend talking to your colleagues as opposed to anybody outside your corporation? Mm. No, professionally, exclude your family, okay, and friends. And it turns out to be most of the time, obviously, you spend inside the four walls. And by the way, maybe for most corporate employees it's a good idea, but not for those who are in charge of innovation. By the way, it's irrelevant whether you're in CVC or not in CVC.
Agree.
If you're in internal innovation, you should spend more time getting outside. So different industries, different educational background, different ages, different geographies. If you look at the corporate executive LinkedIn, it's mostly your company, maybe your previous company, maybe the school you went to. And I think that it's really important. The best ideas in the disruptive world very often will come outside your industry. And I think if you look at a lot of CEOs who are running very successful companies, and by the way, not in a technology, you know, we talk about a lot about technology, but I would like to emphasize that it's not about technology, okay? Or very traditional companies, they really try to go outside. They really also try to make sure that their team members that are in charge of innovation, that are in charge of designing for the future, looking outside. They talk to their customers, they talk to the potential, they talk to potential customers, they talk to people in the adjacent industries. And maybe sometimes they talk to completely kind of strangers, because again, you never know where that disruption is effectively going to come from.
There is value in serendipity when searching for innovation.
It's interesting, there is a value for serendipity, but unless you have a prepared mind, this serendipity will pass you. It's very important. We believe in luck, and I think luck plays a very important role in life. But in real life, not when you buy a lottery ticket, but in real life, I think luck is something that happens, but most people don't take because they're not prepared for their luck.
They don't see it.
They don't see it because they're not prepared, okay? So I think having the prepared mind is also, it's another principle in the book, but it's also very important.
Can you speak about the prepared mind? Because I think this is actually part of upfront work that's needed to create opportunities for innovation and breakthrough.
Prepared mind effectively is a deep dive into something that is happening right now, or you think that is going to happen in the future in your industry, in a specific space. And preparing your mind might take different forms. For example, recently, Jensen Huang, the CEO of NVIDIA, gave a talk to our students at Stanford, at the business school. And what was the most impressive, I think, and he's a very impressive guy, okay? But what was the most impressive was the following. Look, he achieved fame, success, wealth, okay? Every single day, he still spends, I think, 2 to 3 hours studying, preparing his mind.
Yeah.
Wow. That's impressive, okay?
Very.
That's impressive. And he, I think it's a, presumably it's a godly, it's a closely guarded secret of what exactly he's studying right now. But think about, you identify an interesting idea, an interesting space you would like potentially to invest in, again, within the company, outside the company, you spend a lot of effort trying to learn. Now, then it's going to be it will pay back. How it is going to pay back? So let's say then you see a very interesting opportunity. Maybe a new market, a new technology solution, whatever. And they're going to bet on this. So they may lose this bet. But within this bet, they're going to typically meet every single startup.
Yep.
Because they would like to choose the best.
Yeah, in a way, I feel like we always talk about connecting the dots. But you need to research the dots to know where they are before you connect them.
Right.
So in my last question, I want to talk about another principle, which is about the jockey. And this is one term which is so well understood in VC, which I think most corporations have no idea what it is. Can you talk about why it's so important?
Absolutely. Again, it's it's principle number 4 in the book, and I think it's another critical principle. First of all, what is a jockey? In the VC world, jockey is effectively human capital of the startup. It's the founders, but also it's the early employees, so it's the team.
Mm.
And typically, for a startup, it's a small team.
Yep.
And then there's a horse, okay? And what is the horse? It's a business model, and it's a product, and it's market, and it's go-to-market strategy, and I can continue. Now, obviously, if you don't have a horse at all, if you have a donkey...
You won't go far.
Or you cannot jump over, okay? So you need to have a horse. But this is something that is important that every single smart VC knows, is that there are many horses in every single race. Many horses, okay? And typically, in today's world, in every single space, only a couple of horses might win. Typically, it's a big winner, a small winner, and then it doesn't matter. Now, which horse is going to win? It's not just because of luck. It's because of who is going to execute. That is critical. Therefore, smart VCs, especially early stage VCs, they will not invest unless they believe in the jockey. And in fact, what my research shows is that the founding team is by far the single most important factor in deciding whether to invest. When we go to a large corporation, all of us have been to budget decisions or project decisions where there's a huge 100-page deck with all this full of Excel tables and sometimes prepared by consultants, etc. Okay? Are there people mentioned there?
So they are just looking at the horses.
They're looking just at the horses, okay? And in fact, what typically happens is that they will make a decision to invest, and only then they will ask, who is going to be in charge of that? Or actually maybe, okay, Nicola, you're going to be in charge of that. Okay, now let's assemble the team, okay? And again, and I would like to emphasize that this, in the traditional environment of stability, that's a good decision. In the traditional environment, horse is much more important than jockey. Because at the end of the day, we just replace the jockeys, okay, and it's going to work. In today's environment, that is no longer the case. And so therefore, I think that some corporations might have interesting horses. They can't afford them. Mm-hmm. Not because they don't have resources, financial resources, or IP, etc., because they don't have people. They don't have the right set of people.
Ilya, I'm really glad we finished the interview with people, because at the end, building the future needs people and the right people with a venture mindset. We talked about a few principles, but there are more principles in your book, so I will invite the audience to go and read the book. Thank you very much,
and make
Ilya.
Sure that your CEO reads the book and the board.
To every CEOs.
Yep.
Thank you, Ilya.
Absolutely.